The ship's steward came back to Burnham. The expression in his eyes had changed. He apologized. He still could not send the message, he said, but at least now he had an explanation. An accident had occurred involving Millet's ship. In fact, he said, the Olympic was at that moment speeding north at maximum velocity to come to her aid, with instructions to receive and care for injured passengers. He knew nothing more. Burnham shifted his leg and winced, and waited for more news. He hoped that when the Olympic at last reached the site of the accident, he would find Millet and hear him tell some outrageous story about the voyage. In the peace of his stateroom, Burnham opened his diary. That night, the fare came back to him with extra clarity. Chicago, 1890 to 1891. How easy it was to disappear. 1,000 trains a day entered or left Chicago. Many of these trains brought single young women who had never even seen a city, but now hoped to make one of the biggest and toughest their home. Jane Addams, the urban reformer who founded Chicago's Hull House, wrote, "Never before in civilization have such numbers of young girls been suddenly released from the protection of the home and permitted to walk unattended upon the city streets and to work under alien roofs." The women sought work as typists, stenographers, seamstresses, and weavers. The men who hired them were for the most part moral citizens intent on efficiency and profit, but not always. On March 30, 1890, an officer of the First National Bank placed a warning in the Help Wanted section of the Chicago Tribune to inform female stenographers of our growing conviction that no thoroughly honorable businessman who is this side of dotage ever advertises for a lady stenographer who is a blonde, is good-looking, is quite alone in the city, or will transmit her photograph. All such advertisements upon their face bear the marks of vulgarity, nor do we regard it as safe for any lady to answer such unseemly utterances. The women walked to work on streets that angled past bars, gambling houses, and bordellos. Vice thrived, with official indulgence. The parlors and bedrooms in which honest folk lived were, as now, rather dull places, wrote Ben Hecht late in his life, trying to explain this persistent trait of old Chicago. It was pleasant, in a way, to know that outside their windows the devil was still capering in a flare of brimstone. In an analogy that would prove all too apt, Max Weber likened the city to a human being with his skin removed. Anonymous death came early and often. Each of the 1,000 trains that entered and left the city did so at grade level. You could step from a curb and be killed by the Chicago Limited. Every day, on average, 2 people were destroyed at the city's rail crossings. Their injuries were grotesque. Pedestrians retrieved severed heads. There were other hazards. Streetcars fell from drawbridges. Horses bolted and dragged carriages into crowds. Fires took 12 lives a day. There was diphtheria, typhus, cholera, influenza. And there was murder. In the time of the fair, the rate at which men and women killed each other rose sharply throughout the nation, but especially in Chicago, where police found themselves without the manpower and expertise to manage the volume. In the first 6 months of 1892, the city experienced nearly 800 homicides, 4 a day. Most were prosaic, arising from robbery, argument, and sexual jealousy. Men shot women, women shot men, and children shot each other by accident. But all this could be understood. Nothing like the Whitechapel killings had occurred. Jack the Ripper's 5 murder spree in 1888 had defied explanation and captivated readers throughout America who believed such things could not happen in their own hometowns. Yet things were changing. Everywhere one looked, the boundary between moral and the wicked seemed to be degrading. Elizabeth Cady Stanton argued in favor of divorce. Victoria Woodhull advocated free love. A young woman named Borden killed her parents. And in Chicago, a young, handsome doctor stepped from a train, his surgical valise in hand. He entered a world of clamor, smoke, and steam, refulgent with the scents of murdered cattle and pigs. He found it to his liking. The letters came later, from the Segrands, Williamses, and Smythes, and untold others, addressed to that strange, gloomy castle at 63rd and Wallace, pleading for the whereabouts of daughters and daughters' children. It was so easy